That's phenomenal. I mean, they're just such a fun read. It's really a good read.
So these pictures date.
These pictures date. That is a good question. When did one of these pictures dated?
I'm surprised it's closed.
1810.
1810.
Oh no,
Okay.
wait, that's the first one. The first one is 1810. And the other two, let's see, 1735.
Wow. Which one, 1735? The
The
first one
second
or
one.
the second
The
one?
second, the pair.
Set.
Yeah, the set.
1735.
Yeah. 1820,
And the first
1735.
one was 18.
1810.
1810.
Okay, I think we'll get started. Okay, all right. So this is gonna be a lot of fun. Oh, first thing before I start, Yiddish is dated. Remember that whole question of when Yiddish? Obviously, historians argue about it, but somewhere in the 10th, 11th century, I think the first indications of Yiddish, the first sources that they found things that were written in Yiddish. That's just an FYI. But okay, let's talk about colonial Jews. So, Jewish history in America is dated to 1654. Why that year? It's not the first time there was a Jew in America. There were Jews in America earlier than that. But in 1654, do you
Their own
know?
synagogue?
No, later. 1654, 23, but that's a good idea. 23 Jews landed in New Amsterdam, escaping Recife, Brazil. They were subjects, they had come from Amsterdam, and when the Dutch conquered Portugal, I'm sorry, Portugal, when they conquered Brazil from Portugal, a lot of people from Amsterdam came to try and make their fortunes in the New World. And Jews had a nice, they had a great life there. There was religious tolerance in Amsterdam, and they had that in Brazil also. However, after a few decades, Portugal recaptured Brazil from the Dutch. And once Portugal was back in control, they reinstituted the Inquisition. It's Portugal the Inquisition. That basically meant any of the Jews there, especially the Jews that had been there, had been new Christians, and once the Dutch took over, it came out as Jews, and they had to hightail it out of there. So most went back to Amsterdam. Some, however, decided to go to the closest Dutch colony, which was New Amsterdam. That was the next closest colony. And so they land in Recife, Brazil in 1654. And they are considered that is the date for the beginning of the American Jewish community. That's the date historians use, and whenever you hear like 350 years since Jews, I don't know if you remember that, in 2004, there was a whole hoopla, 350 years of Jews in America. That's the date they're all working off of. So why is that considered to be the first Jewish community? So there are a number of reasons why that can be considered the first, even though there were Jews before. So one reason, which we already talked about, was that they had official permission to stay. If you remember, we mentioned this, that Peter Stuyvesant tried to get them thrown out of the colony, and Amsterdam Jews intercede, citing a mercantilist argument of Jews are good for the economy, let them stay, and we're shareholders in your company, let them stay, etc., etc. And the Dutch West Indies Company accepts that argument and tells Peter Stuyvesant the Jews have permission to stay. So that is one reason why that's considered the first community. They have official permission. Another reason is what was different about these 23 people than the single lone male travelers coming in and out, a male tradesman and merchants, peddlers coming in and out. What's different about the
They come as
23?
families,
They
or
came
just
as families. They were
right.
family units. There were men, women, and children. And you have no community without family. When you have families, you have a community. And that's why this is considered the beginning of the American Jewish community, because it's the first time there was Jewish families. And then obviously that lends itself the ability to perpetuate, for the community to perpetuate itself. Now, a little side note that is just completely off topic. It's just a funny tidbit. How do we know the Jews arrived? There's a couple of ways we know. There's record of they arrived right before Rosh Hashanah, and there's records of services being held that, you know, within a week or so. But another way we know is that within a week of landing on New Amsterdam soil, the 23 Jews had sued each other and were in court. So that's how we know. We know from the court records of them having sued each other, because along the way they were attacked by pirates and their possessions were taken. And so when they landed, they didn't have the money to pay their fares. And so other Jews' possessions were sold to pay for the fares of their compatriots, and they were suing, why did I have to pay for your fair? But, you know, as far as the people, New Amsterdam, you know, as far as the people running the boat, you know, who wanted to be paid, the Jews were a unit. They weren't looking at the Jews as individual people. They were looking at them as the Jews. So the Jews were responsible for the Jews' fares. Whereas they were saying, you know, this woman is suing this guy saying, like, why is my stuff sold to pay for your fare? I don't need to pay for you. You know, so that's how we know they were there, because they were suing each other. Okay, so that's 1654. By the time the U.S. is born in 1776, there were only about 2,000 Jews in America. So we're talking about a very small number. As a basis for comparison, Jewish population in the world was about 1 million in 1654 and about 2 million in 1776. The vast, vast majority of the Jewish world in the 17th and 18th century lived in Poland, Lithuania, and the Ottoman Empire. In about the 1760s, scholars believe that there were 750,000 Jews just in Poland, Lithuania. So in the 1760s. So 1760s in the Polish-Lithuanian kingdom, you have 750,000 Jews. In all of the United States of America, you have 2,000. So it's actually a very small number. Today, where are the two major Jewish centers of population? Israel and America. Mm-hmm. That is recent. The majority of Jews being focused in those two places is post-Holocaust. Right. Okay. That's before that those weren't centers. Mm-hmm. So what do we care? What do we care if there's only 2,000 Jews in America at the time? So what do we even care about, you know, about the colonial Jews? They're interesting. they're a unique group. They're definitely colorful. And what's interesting about it is how many of their issues are the same issues that the Jewish community is dealing with today. And specifically, you know, this issue of how to best negotiate being Jewish and being American in a country which welcomes us as Jews, which was not the reality in Europe at the time. So, okay, let's start.
Question.
Yeah.
So these Jews are Sephardi Jews.
The Recife 23 that would have right. were Sephardi. Mm-hmm. Jews who come in are both Sephardi and Ashkenaz, although the community is still kind of dominated by the Sephardic flavor, so to speak, in that, you know, like the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue is right. the major synagogue in New York, I mean by the New York. The thing is that even like Abigail Levy Franks, they were actually Ashkenaz. But until the 1860s, when Jews start migrating from Central Europe in great numbers, the community is dominated by Sephardim, or at least, even if they're not actually Sephardim, it's a Sephardic community. Like, that's the flavor of the community until it gets majorly overrun by Ashkenazim, and by, you know, by the end of the 19th century, I mean, it's been completely overrun. But yes, it would still be a Sephardic community. Okay, so let's look at Martha Levy at the spinet. That's what this painting is called. This one should have been uploaded to the website. Okay, so it was painted in 1810 by Thomas Scully, who was a renowned portrait artist. Okay, what do you see? Tell me about Martha Levy. Let's just see if we can. Tell me about Martha Levy.
Dressed very closely.
That's why I was wondering which year.
I mean, she's not dressed. Sleeves are kind of short. Neckline's a little low, but she's not.
She has short hair.
It's really not a looker.
Right, although you don't know what.
Maybe he wasn't like a painter.
You don't know what was beauty, you know, at the time.
Right.
Because certainly a portrait artist is going to flatter the subject. Okay, so she's. Okay, tell me more. Tell me about her.
No, I think that does she really have short hair, or she has something going down the back?
I think it's up.
Oh, okay.
I don't think she would have short hair. I think it's up. So I just really turn this. This is a little. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so tell me about her clothing.
Well?
What's her social class?
Definitely high class.
Okay, she's good. She's a high class woman. Yeah. She is wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
She is well dressed. I mean, you can tell that she's wealthy. Number one is because look at her clothing. She's wearing a very fancy dress.
Right.
She owns a piano.
Right. They owned a piano. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And even the fact that she's having her portrait done, I mean, you have to be a certain class. You can somewhat probably assume she's probably literate.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I mean, even though she's holding a music book, a piano book, but yeah, she can probably read, right? If she's taught to read music, exactly.
That's the next level.
Right. Yeah. So what do you think this painting could tell us about Jewish life in America in the early 19th century?
That some of them are well off.
Okay. That they're wealthy.
Uh-huh.
Okay. They're successful.
Yeah.
And what do you think? Why present herself standing at the spinet as opposed to with a music book, as opposed to in some more Jewish setting?
Because they want to acculturate. They want to be part of culture.
Good. They're trying to fit in.
Right.
Fit in and assimilate. Okay. So a little backstory about our subject here, Martha Levy. Martha Levy was not Jewish. She's actually not Jewish. Her father was Moses Levy, a Jew from a well-respected colonial Jewish family. Her mother, however, was Mary Pierce Levy, who was an Episcopalian Methodist Christian. Martha was raised as a Methodist, and she actually left no Jewish descendants. So then, now with my big reveal, she's not even Jewish. Why is this painting still important to our understanding of colonial Jews?
Because a Jew married a non-Jew, and and he was well off.
Right. So if we're talking about fitting in, okay, obviously we still know that Jews are wealthy. If we're talking about wanting to fit in, it's only magnified by knowing that she wasn't even Jewish. And it also makes you wonder about what's going on in terms of intermarriage. And actually, it makes you wonder, is this a typical situation? And the answer is actually yes. Rates of intermarriage were high as 25%. Now, 25% might not seem high with the 50% intermarriage rate we have today, but
with only 2,000 Jews.
Yeah.
With only 2,000 Jews, that's right. That's
based, very high.
That is very high percentage. Mm-hmm. And also, when you're comparing to the fact that what is the intermarriage rate in the rest of the Jewish world?
Probably not great.
Like close to zero. There's like a close to zero. There's no intermarriage. I mean, that intermarriage would be very rare in Europe at the time. I mean, that would be a huge deal. But So 25% is like astronomical compared to the rest of the Jewish world. If you look in the letters, the ones from, where are those, last week's, one of those sources, do you have them? Does anyone have the letters from last week?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You do? Okay. I actually think I forgot my copy name.
Colonial America?
Yeah, so you'll see, you don't happen to have two copies of that, do you? Okay, so.
I don't have two copies, but
okay. All right. Yeah, sorry. Okay. So one second, we're not going to do Abigail. Okay, Frank's. Where's my name? Oh, thank you. So if you look at the sources, in the middle, towards the end of the packet, intermarriage and conversion, you'll see that intermarriage was a big problem, and She'erith Israel, the congregation, which is the Spanish and Portuguese, made rules to try to legislate against intermarriage. And it was that, you know, it's that big of a problem. And here they're talking, there are letters here about people who were asking for conversions, you know, people who are looking to convert. And the assumption is they were looking to convert in order to marry someone Jewish, and this was a big issue at the time. You know, it's an issue on two. It's a social issue because, you know, they have to deal with the perpetuation of their community. It's also kind of a religious issue because there is no rabbi in America at the time. So conversion is not, it's not so simple. So anyway, that's interesting letter.
Rabbi?
Oh, what's the date of the first rabbi? I'm so exhausted. I probably did that. Tell you that.
You can take it offline and tell us next time.
Yeah, I can take that offline. I do not know that there was actually. I'm not sure there was a rabbi in America in 1810, but it doesn't matter. See, that's part of in the colonial world. And in the Jewish world, there was no strong religious authorities. Mm-hmm. America, from the start, was anti-authority. So even the Catholic, it took a while for the Catholic Church to get itself organized. It took a while for the Protestant churches to get themselves organized until there was the first, you know, bishop and deacon. And they didn't have leadership either. Even in Christianity, they didn't have leadership. And the West, as bad as it was in the East, in the West, the West was considered a missionary area. It was considered an area for missionaries. Like, it was so devoid of religion. And Judaism was the same. Any religion was very, you know, it was haphazard. People did whatever they wanted. And individual congregations did whatever they wanted. There was no central authority. And that, to a great extent, has lasted until today, where America in religion in America is very decentralized. And that's part of like the ethos of America and individualism in America. So conversion's is gonna be a problem. It's gonna be a problem You know, and also there's also an element like, you know, they need to just protect their position in American society. And I don't know if they want to just have so many people converting to Judaism. And there's a lot of issues involved here and that are revolving around marriage and trying to perpetuate the Jewish community and make sure that people who are Jewish are getting married to each other and prevent intermarriage and both perpetuate their community while protecting their position in society. So why would the rate of intermarriage be so high in America compared? Okay. All right. So
there's just not that many to choose from. So.
Okay. Okay, good. Not that many to choose from and many non-Jews to choose from. And there's not so much separation in America the way it was naturally built into the Jewish community in Europe. All right, what else? What do we know about the people who came?
The
who talked Christian, about this
they
all.
Were new Christians.
And no, but the Jews who came. Like, if a Jew would, if a Jew decides to come move to America in the 1780s, what do we talked about this, I think, last week or two weeks ago.
They wanted to shed.
To some extent,
the most religious.
Right, it's a self-selecting population that's probably not the most religious. They're not necessarily religious. They do not mind living in a place that has no Jewish infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And there's another a letter that I put in here about what's the date of that letter? The mikvah letter, where this man is writing how terrible it is that there is no mikvah. 1784, petitions Philadelphia congregation, which is actually called Mikvah Israel, but does not have a mikvah. That's 1784. There's no mikvah in Philadelphia. Hey, let's build one. So we're talking about a place with no...
the rabbi there in that mikvah is...
Leeser?
Yeah, that's it. Okay, I had read something about him.
Yeah, he's the one I'm trying to remember the date he came. I'm trying to remember the date he came, and I'm annoyed with myself that I can't. That I'm just not remembering.
I think it was in the mid-1800s.
I also think it's a little bit. It's just a little bit later. Go for it, Leeser, L-E-E-S-E-R, first name Isaac.
Right, Isaac. That's right.
Was he like a prominent rabbi in Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Carry on.
Okay. All right. All right. Now, again, the type of people who will come might be those who are not into rabbinical authority and want to come here to escape that. You know, America is very different than, there's no rabbinical authority at all. It's very different than Europe, where in Europe, you have people, we talked about Haskalah, you have people who are really diminishing their practice and are not practicing Judaism as much. But they have like a whole intellectual framework for why they are not practicing Judaism anymore, why they're not practicing Judaism in the traditional way. There's a whole intellectual defense because of this, because of that. In America, they're just not doing it. You know, there's no sense of like we need an intellectual framework for why we are reducing our practice, for why we're practicing differently, for why we're not, you know, practicing religion as much. We're just not practicing. We're just not. It's a very different mentality in America than in Europe.
And yet they were hanging on to the
They are. He was, I mean, when you read the way they wrote about him, he's considered to have been like very zealous. Very zealous. No, the one who petitioned for the mikvah. But, years.
It says here, well, this is Wikipedia, so take it for what it's
worth. Yes.
He was born in 1806. And it says he was born in Germany, in someplace Rhine, Westphalia.
Yeah, he wasn't born in America.
And he died in 1868. And it says he was an American Ashkenazi Jewish lay minister of religion, author, translator, editor, and publisher, pioneer of the Jewish pulpit in the United States, and founder of the Jewish Press of America. So is it a different person?
No, it sounds like him.
Yeah, okay. And this is what he looked like.
Does it say anything about what congregation, where he lived?
Life, elected in Philadelphia, published a later career.
When does it have him arriving in America?
It doesn't say, but wait, I'm going to go back. But let's look at his picture.
Remember, so guess like 1830s.
See what he looks like.
Like a nice colonial American here with our viewers at home. A nice colonial American. So he must have come, if he was 18, he must have come in his 30s, I would guess, that he arrived somewhere around 1830. Mikveh Israel. Letter, it's somewhere in the 1830s.
So, you know, so interestingly enough, here it says he's not actually a rabbi.
Right.
But he's more, and you know, I remember reading something about him that they listened to him. He was more of a leader of the community.
There aren't actually American rabbi. Yeah,
well,
that's very possible.
He created the pulpit.
Also, it's he was a chazan. A lot of times, the chazan was the leader. Although the truth is, that's a really hard designation to begin with, because it's a little bit unclear what mm-hmm. what is being a rabbi anyway. It gets into the whole what is smicha, and
right,
which is much more defined today than it would have been back then anyway. But yeah, it's very possible that he didn't have any formal smicha, mm-hmm. but still had that position. But that's, again, not surprising. And it's not mm-hmm. surprising that people, that the American congregation wouldn't care if he had the formal right. designation or not. Right. So another thing about the population, remember that America is somewhat of a frontier. So the people who, the type of personality has to be someone who's adventurous, who's mm-hmm. into risk-taking, and who's going to make money. And that might not be the typical, you know, devout, traditional Jew. Mm-hmm. So I want to look at now, we have the Martha Levy, and there's a really phenomenal letter which talks about Jewish life, which was written by Rebecca Samuel, a woman named Rebecca Samuel, in the 1790s. The exact date is unknown, but sometime in the 1790s. And it was sent from Petersburg, Virginia, to her parents in Hamburg. This is at the very end. This is actually taken from the Jewish Women's Archive. And the source you can find anywhere, but it just happens to be I took it from that website, which I love.
I love it too.
What?
Some interesting tidbits in that.
Yeah. Okay. Dear parents, I hope my letter will ease your mind. You can now be reassured and send me one of the family to Charleston, South Carolina. Let's go. Let's get some more of the family over here to America. This is the place to which, with God's help, we will go after Passover. The whole reason why we are leaving this place, meaning Petersburg, is because of its lack of Yiddishkeit, Jewishness. Dear parents, I know quite well you will not want me to bring up my children like Gentiles. Here, they cannot become anything else. Jewishness is pushed aside here. They are here in Petersburg, Virginia, 10 or 12 Jews, and they are not worthy of being called Jews. We have a shochet here who goes to market and buys treif meat and then brings it home. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the people worshipped here without one sefer Torah, and not one of them wore the talit or the arba kanfot, except Hyman, that's her husband, and my Sammy's godfather. That's obviously her son. The latter is an old man of 60, a man from Holland. He has been in America for 30 years already. For 20 years, he was in Charleston, and he has been living here for 4 years. He does not want to remain here any longer and will go with us to Charleston. In that place, there's a blessed community of 300 Jews. So that was 300 Jews in Charleston. That was a big community. Oh, yeah, a lot of the southern towns, and especially port mm-hmm. cities, had huge Jewish communities. And, I mean, whatever, 300 Jews we wouldn't consider large, but that was very, that was large for the time.
And her family was
there. Been there for, yeah. You cannot believe me that I crave to see a synagogue to which I can go. The way we live now is no life at all. We do not know what the Sabbath and the holidays are. On the Sabbath, all the Jewish shops are open, and they do business on that day as they do throughout the whole week. But ours we do not allow to open. With us, there is still some Sabbath. You must believe me that in our house, we all live as Jews as much as we can. So we have, you remember the Jewish time of Pauline Wengroff and Glickel and Hamlin's world, mm-hmm. where everywhere would have been closed on mm-hmm. Shabbos. And here now is the polar opposite. They are not living in Jewish time anymore. They're right. living on American Christian time. Mm-hmm. But she's assuring her parents. And obviously, you know, there's something saying you got to take this with a grain of salt, because she is writing to her parents. We are still living as Jews, regardless of what you've heard about what's going on in America. Although with her little qualification, as much as we can. Okay, so that's her religious life. So tell me, what do we know from these two paragraphs about religious life in...
Almost non-existent.
Okay, so that most everyone's not observing things, but there are some people, herself included, who still care and want to observe things. Okay, that's part one. Now we have the part two of our letter. As for the Gentiles, we have nothing to complain about. For the sake of a livelihood, we do not have to leave here, nor do we have to leave because of debts. I believe ever since Hyman has grown up, he has not had it so good. You cannot know what a wonderful country this is for the common man. Why? What do they not have here that she had back in Europe?
Anti-Semitism.
That's exactly what she's talking about here. Don't have to complain about the Gentiles. One can live here peacefully. Hyman made a clock that goes very accurately, just like the one in, I'm going to guess, Buchenstrasse in Hamburg. Now you can imagine what honors Hyman has been getting here. In all Virginia, there is no clock like this one. And Virginia is the greatest province in the whole of America, and America is the largest section of the world. Now you know what sort of country this is. It is not too long since Virginia was discovered. It is a young country, and it's amazing to see the business they do in this little Petersburg. At times, many of 1,000 hogsheads of tobacco arrive at one time, et cetera, et cetera. It's shipped here from the whole world. Now, what is really interesting about about becoming a watchmaker? He can become a watchmaker in America. He may not have been able to do that in Europe, because so many of the trades and the artisans, those crafts, were restricted professions for Jews. He wouldn't have been able to have this job. You know, probably at, you know, one can assume that her family was poor, that they, if you had money in Europe, you didn't come to America. Certainly not at this point in history. There's no reason to go. You went if you wanted to try to do better economically. Right. I mean, it wouldn't have been anyone's first choice to leave their family forever and go to this, you know, underdeveloped, you know, not yet developed country. When Judah, my brother, comes here, he can become a watchmaker and goldsmith if he so desires. Here it is not like Germany, where a watchmaker is not permitted to sell silverware. They do not know otherwise here. They expect a watchmaker to be a silversmith here. Hyman has more to do in making silverware than with watchmaking. He has a journeyman, a silversmith, a very good artisan, and he, Hyman, takes care of the watches. This work is well paid here, but in Charleston, it pays even better. All the people who hear that we are leaving give us their blessings. They say that it is sinful that such blessed children should be brought up here in Petersburg. My children cannot learn anything here, nothing Jewish, nothing of general culture. So she's saying,
it's a hick town.
It's a hick town, yeah, exactly, exactly. My Shone, God bless her. And Glickle of Hamlin also had a daughter named Shone, so it must have been a name.
Oh,
it's, Shoney. Shoney.
Like
Shoney.
Like
Shoney. Is that Shana?
It's pretty.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, good.
Shoney,
good. She's already 3 years old, and I think it's time she should learn something, and she has a good head to learn. I've taught her the bedtime prayers and grace after meals in just 2 lessons. I believe no one among the Jews here can do as well as she. And my Sammy, God bless him, is already beginning to talk. And that's, I could write more, however, I do not have any more paper. Remain your devoted daughter and servant, Rebecca, the wife of Chaim, the son of Samuel, the Levite. It's such a great letter. It's just such a great letter because it just tells you so much.
Mm-hmm. So who is this letter from? Do we know?
Yeah, Rebecca Samuel.
Oh, Rebecca.
It's a woman.
Oh, right.
Yeah, do we know anything about her? No. No, we don't know anything about her that's not in her letter.
Wow.
We learn
a lot.
We learn a lot.
Yeah.
We learn that the world, how desolate the world America was in terms of Jewishness,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, they're accepted by the Christian world. There's no major anti-Semitism. You know, she writes no anti-Semitism, and they're allowed professions that they weren't allowed to be in Europe, and that's mm-hmm. nice. So, how does Rebecca feel about America?
It's a great land of opportunity, but it's devoid. It's
so
a
spiritual.
Barren wasteland
right.
in terms of Jewish
Judaism.
And it's funny, but wherever she was, what is Petersburg, Virginia?
Yeah.
It's still devoid of Jewish.
Is it still a hick town? Also, probably. Right. Okay. So she has her criticism of America. Does she want to leave and go back to Europe?
No.
No.
She's
no way.
Inviting her family to come.
Uh-huh.
Right. Bring more of the family over. If anything, she's let's try to build the community a little more. And what's important about bringing the family over means she can support somebody else.
Right.
She's saying we're better established. We now have enough work for someone else to come over. She's certainly not going to bring someone over that she can't feed. Or that she's going to have to support.
She's asking for her brother to come.
Right.
When
right.
my brother comes.
Because
right.
it can be a watchmaker.
It can work.
Bring
yeah. Bring him into
yeah.
the business. That's exactly right. Bring him into the business. There's another letter in here, which you can look at a few times, written by Benjamin Rush, the doctor. That he was a prominent doctor, and he was invited to a Jewish wedding. And he just writes about it. He writes about this wedding that he attended and all the customs. And it's really interesting because it's a chance to see a Jewish wedding from the perspective of a Christian observer. Yeah, it should be in here. I think it's in here. I think it's right before the Rebecca Samuels letter. No, it's right before, Jewish Marriage Seminar. Right. I do happen to love the ending where he says, this was such a great wedding. It's so wonderful. And I can't wait until all these Jews unite with the Christians. And, you know, there's that, like, a little bit of, like, you know, the missionary tone at the end. Like, there's such nice people, such a nice wedding. I can't wait till they're all Christians like us. But, yeah, there's no, you, when you read about the way he describes it, his only language is the language of Christianity.
Right.
So he, right, he totally tells the story. It's just great to read it, you know, talking about the canopy and how it was held. He really just describes the Jewish wedding ceremony. So it's really nice to just see what the customs were at the time, you know, just to see and just so the way he describes it. And then, you know, again, still as tolerant as he is, he's still, you know, there is the hope that these people will, you know, become Christian, which actually probably a lot of the evangelical Christian world would still probably, you know, believe and say today. Okay, so we have a situation where we have a country that is accepting of Jews and welcoming to Jews and friendly to Jews, but there is an issue of how do we continue to lead a Jewish life in this country. Okay, so now that takes us to Abigail Levy Franks, to our others. Okay, we're good inside. Okay, good. Okay, these are two pictures of the Franks family. The woman on the left, the one alone, is Abigail Levy Franks. She was one of the pillars of one of the grand dames of colonial New York society, and a Jew. And the one on the right, the picture on the right, are two of her children, David and Phila. Now, she is, by the way, in case you're curious, Abigail Levy Franks. Yes, related to Martha Levy. Like Martha Levy of the Spinet? No, these are actually earlier. So probably it would be a cousin or a great niece or a cousin. No, she's related. It's the same. It's the same prominent family she came from as a prominent family that Moses Levy came from.
Father, obviously.
Right.
If she's Jewish.
Right. Abigail. Okay. No, well, she's younger.
Oh, okay.
She's
oh.
younger. Because this one was painted. Okay. This one was painted earlier.
Yes. She could be like a grandmother.
Right, but she's.
Because that was 1810. This is 1735.
Right. I do not think she is a grandmother. I think she's either a great aunt or just a cousin, just because she's not the grandmother. Well, we'll get to that. She's not. Okay. Okay. So.
They all look exactly alike.
The three of them? I know.
I thought they were the same person.
Yeah, they're not. I know. I had that moment also.
They are the same.
Yeah, and that might be because they are mother and children, and might be because
the painter has one way of doing faces.
Right, has one way of doing faces. So these portraits, like I said, were painted in 1735. So Abigail Levy Franks, she is born in London in 1696 to a prominent Jewish family. She and her family settle in the American colonies in 1703, and she marries Jacob Franks, who is a wealthy Jewish merchant. She died in 1756 in New York. Okay, so what do these pictures tell us about her family?
Well,
about her and her family.
Really well to do.
Okay, good. All right, very well to do. Wealthy.
Velvet, exactly.
Right. Wealthy, fashionable. Look at his clothing. I mean, it's so fashionable. Right, fashionable for the times.
Lace.
The dog, the flower. It's very, it's very, right.
What was her husband's name again?
Jacob. Not as modest as Martha Levy. You got a little bit of bosom going on here with her and the daughter. The children are beautifully dressed. These actually were made to hang together. It's the same like pastoral scene behind both of them. What is interesting? What's interesting to some extent about these pictures is what's missing. What's not in these pictures?
The husband.
Okay, yeah, well, besides him. Would you know, looking at these,
jewelry,
that they were Jewish?
No.
No, nothing. There's no, no. Nothing. Mm-mm. No indication anywhere, nothing Jewish about these pictures. These are American portraits. There's nothing Jewish here. Especially with him. I mean, there's nothing, no indication of Jewish dress at all. Now, she and her husband were actually pillars of the Jewish community and very important in Sherith Israel, in the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. They were also in high standing in non-Jewish society. She was a welcome visitor at the governor's mansion, which was a, you know, that's prestigious, welcome visitor at the governor's mansion. She's important in society. Okay, now, we know a lot about Abigail Levy Franks because she was a prolific letter writer. She had a son that she sent to, London, back to the family in London. It's her son, Naftali, and she sent him back to London to join the family business there, make his fortune there, and also in the hopes he would marry Jewish. They would get married there instead of a family. So from that point on, she never saw him again. She just, they corresponded via letters, and she wrote him a lot of letters, and those letters are extant. They were preserved. So we know a lot of her from these letters. So she... Okay, so she has like five children. Two sons were sent to London in the hopes they would, again, succeed financially, marry Jewish. So what does she write? What does she write them about? There's an entire book of her letters, to her son, which I gave you two of them. Very little about Judaism. She writes, we know that she lived an observant Jewish life. We know that she was an active member of Sherith Israel. We know that her children attended Sherith Israel's school. We know she kept a kosher home. She actually warns her son Naftali not to eat anything in his uncle's house except bread and butter because she didn't trust the kashrus there. She expected him to daven every morning. We know she observed Shabbos. We know she observed holidays. We know she believed in God. And that she believed in Judaism. We know that. But we don't really see that so much. There's no description of Shabbos or holiday meals. There's nothing about synagogue services or about ritual practice. In fact, in one of the letters, which I gave you, the first letter, you'll see she... if you look on that first letter, page 104, 105, those pages. So the first part, she's talking about trying to get pet squirrels for her daughters. And the second half, she talks something about the synagogue. And she says, I love this. And indeed, she's talking about this woman. And indeed, I don't often see her, nor any of our ladies, but at synagogue, for they are a stupid set of people. But mum for that. So she doesn't really have the nicest things to say about the Jewish women. And perhaps because she was in such a higher strata of society than most of them, there was an element of her looking down upon them. So what does she write about? She writes about literature. She writes about New York City politics. She is well-educated. Her spelling is horrendous, but that is actually normal for the time period. She writes about politics. She writes about American society. She's very invested in American society and American culture and American politics. She does not see herself as living a separate existence as her neighbors. She's living in the same world they are. She just happens to be Jewish. One of the only interesting things where you see her Judaism is she actually addresses her son as Hartzi, which, if you know a little bit of Yiddish, is both a play on... It's a play on Naftali, and it also is a term of endearment, like heart from Hertz's heart. So it's a little bit of a Yiddish Herzi. Yeah, Herzi. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Herzi, yeah. You got it. Okay, so obviously she knows a little bit of Yiddish. She's using it, although she's writing in English, but she's using it. But they're really not, her letters are not especially Jewish. I mean, if you want to like compare her to Glickal, where every other line is invoking some pasuk, I mean, Glickal's writing is so Jewish. Mm-hmm. And this isn't. This isn't. Again, she's writing about trying to get pet squirrels. Like, it's not. She writes about politics. It's an interesting, you know, this is one of, it's not just a big, important Jewish source. This is one of the most important sources for the time period of just women in colonial America, because we have this body of letters. Okay? So, being that it seems that her Judaism, to some extent, is not really a major part of her life, and she's much more focused on the sex, on all of the sexual, of the I can't get the words that I'm looking for. She's much more focused on like the secular, the culture, the other aspect, the, you know, politics. What's totally fascinating about her is the reaction she has when her daughter intermarries. Her daughter Phila, this one, runs away with one of the Delanceys of like Delancey Street, of like Mayor Delancey.
Really?
Yes. Like one of the, she runs away with Oliver Delancey, marries Oliver Delancey. And he says, and she says, Abigail, that she will never speak to her again. And she never speaks to her and sees her again. She's, so I gave you that letter where she writes about, where she writes about the intermarriage. And I gotta say, it's really, they're hard to read. Where is that? I can, here, where do I want to start this? Dear Phila. Here, I am now retired from town. She has left. She has left. She has like taken a break. She can't even be seen. She cannot even go out in public. She's retired from town and would from myself, if it were possible to have some peace of mind, from the severe affliction I am under on the conduct of that unhappy girl. Good God, what a shock it was when they acquainted me. She had left the house and had been married 6 months. I can hardly hold my pen whilst I'm writing it. And she is going on and on. I never could have imagined, especially if I heard her say so often that no consideration in life ever induced her to disoblige such good parents. I had heard reports of her going to be married to Oliver Delancey, but, you know, she didn't believe it. She didn't believe it. And then cannot believe the horror that she, that this girl, Phila, intermarried. So why? Why? I mean, why do you think Phila intermarried?
There was nobody else to
marry. Okay, to some extent, there's no one else, no one in her, no one Jewish who's her social equal.
Right.
I mean, the greenhorn that just comes over, no way. She ain't going to end up with him. And you even see how her mother refers to the other, the local Jews. So, you know, if she's traveling around the upper echelons of society, she's going to want to marry somebody with the, on the upper echelon of society. Mm-hmm. For Abigail, however, she still has like the Jewishness as being like part of her nature, that even though she doesn't express it so much, it's so integral to her that she can't understand how Phila could transgress it. In a sense, it's very similar to Pauline Wengerhoff, who has this strong Jewishness, doesn't really transmit it, and then is devastated when her kids end up intermarrying.
But that's the way it is here in America.
Right, that you have people who don't give their kids a Jewish education and then can't believe it.
Saying, like, my, in the last generation, say, you know, where in 50s and 60s, where everybody moved to the suburbs and they had these big bar mitzvah parties and then they wondered why their kids didn't marry and they were Jewish.
Right.
It's interesting, though, that she sent both her sons to London to make sure that they kept the Jewish. That she did not look for
the girls.
The girls. So, have somebody come over or have the sons look for someone to send over or something like that.
Like, why weren't they still doing Shidduchim?
Right.
Why?
Well, to some extent, America never the same kind of matchmaker. I mean, you do see some letters of like asking for the parent, having the parents negotiate a match, but it seems obvious that the children knew each other, that they did know each other already. You know, there could be a lot of reasons. Number one is, first of all, it could be, you're right, why'd they bring someone over? But they're not going to send her away. They're probably not going to send an unmarried daughter away the same way they would do a son.
Right.
Also, it could be the family in London could only absorb two of them. You don't know how many of them they could have taken, because she doesn't send. She has three kids that stay in America, a son and two daughters. The son also intermarries. The other daughter remains single. So none of her kids in America marry Jews.
And in London, she's telling her son that they don't keep kosher in London.
Right.
So I wonder what that community is like.
Right, the London.
As opposed to the other communities we've been talking about.
I don't know a lot about London, but I know that at that point, Western Europe is a lot less, generally less observant than Eastern. Because the closer they're getting towards emancipation, the English community is just not Poland. Not Poland. I mean, just look at where the rabbis are coming from. No, they don't have that kind of community. There's no strong community there either. Right.
Anything significant coming out of there.
Right. Exactly. Not until, again, like post-Holocaust. But that, in a sense, you can, to some extent, get where Philo Franks is coming from. She's in a society where she's raised along with Christians. There's no barriers to her full participation in society. In a sense, she's living in a society where these colonial Jews are. I mean, does her son look her brother look Jewish in any way, shape, or form? No. I mean, they're Jews in the home, Americans in the street. There's a challenge here. There's a challenge. So all of the people we've talked about have in common is a struggle of how to square their Judaism with the non-Jewish and the very welcoming non-Jewish world around them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't suffer anti-Semitism. They didn't have legal discrimination. And they're accepted and loved by their Christian neighbors, and sometimes loved and even married by their Christian neighbors.
Right.
And, these obviously aren't the most religious people coming to begin with, because if they're the most religious, they wouldn't have come at all. But at the same time, their Judaism is still important to them. You see that with Rebecca Samuels and even with Abigail Levy Franks. We don't know about Rebecca Samuels' children.
Right.
We don't know what happened to them for all her trying. What happened to those kids? We don't.
But, this is typical. This is like the beginning of the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
Because this is what happens to every generation.
Right. This is, to a great extent, the American story. It's the American narrative. The American narrative is a story that goes to assimilation.
The generation just sheds.
Right.
Everything.
And that's the unique challenge of America, of being Jewish in America, of how one perpetuates the Jewish community in a society that, it's like there's a challenge of anti-Semitism, but then there's the challenge of perpetuating Jewish community in a welcoming society where you do have you can take full advantage of American culture and, have these pressures. I love these pictures. I mean,
it is one thing that to me is missing. Jewelry.
Yeah, it's interesting. None of them have jewelry.
Since they're so extremely wealthy and well-to-do, they're not wearing jewelry.
There's something in Glickle about how jewelry was getting to be a new thing at the time. This is obviously a little bit later, but then again, you don't know what things were like in America.
Right.
You'd have to look at portraits, global portraits, and just see, is there any jewelry in portraits? Was it just not worn, or it wasn't worn for pictures? But yeah, you're right. When you look at their necks, you're like, where's the jewelry?
Where's the jewelry? Because if you look at portraits of... When I lived in California, I used to go to San Francisco a lot for the museums. They had these gorgeous, gorgeous necklaces.
Do you know when? Where?
18th century, 17th century.
Where? In Europe or America?
Europe.
So it's interesting. Well, was it not an American thing? Or did you not do portraits in America? No, because you're right. It does seem like very missing, right? There's no jewelry there.
Yeah.
But I would say that probably wasn't a Jewish thing. That would have been a general.
Well, that changed.
Yes, that did change. That did change. But, you know, it's interesting. What's really interesting just about this time period when we get to America is really you see just from the start that the issues with the American Jewish community in 1654 are the same issues
mm-hmm.
that the American Jewish community is dealing with in 2013. No, circumstances have changed, but it's the same challenge of balancing an American identity and a religious identity and how to make them coexist.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
that was
you.
Great. That was a good time.
Fascinating.
Okay, so next week you have the Bintel Brief. Let me return your letters to you.
Oh, thank you.
What? Did you take a Bintel Brief copy? So again, it was the most popular column in the foreword, which is the most popular paper. You do have
that.
Most popular column in the most popular paper. And
so the late 20th colonial America, correct?
No,
that's the one you
no
need
early 20th
century,
century America.
I had it. I just thought it was
okay.
Early 20th, okay, yes.
Thank you. Was it working this time?